Recorded live at Podcast One, this is Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. And now here's your host, Daniel Bain.
As a boy, I shared a game with my father. We played it every morning till I was three. He would knock on my door and I'd pretend to be asleep till he got right next to the bed. Then I would get up and jump into his arms. Good morning, Papa. And my poppy would tell me that he loved me. We shared a game, knock knock. Until that day when the knock never came, and my mama takes me on a ride past cornfields on this never-ending highway to reach a place of high, rusty gates. A confused little boy, I enter the building carried in my mama's arms, knock knock. We reach a room of windows and brown faces. Behind one of the windows sits my father. I jump out of my mama's arms and run joyously towards my papa's, only to be confronted by this window. I knock knock, trying to break through the glass, trying to get to my father. I knock knock as my mama pulls me away before my papa even says a word. And for years, he has never said a word. And so years later, I write these words for the little boy in me who still awaits his papa's knock. Papa, come home, because I miss you. Miss you waking me up in the mornings and telling me you love me. Papa, come home because there's things I don't know, and I thought maybe you could teach me how to shave, how to dribble a ball, how to talk to a lady, how to walk like a man. Papa, come home, because I decided a while back I want to be just like you, but I'm forgetting who you are. And years later, a little boy cries, and so I write these words, and I try to heal, and I try to father myself, and I dream up a father who says the words my father did not. Dear son, I'm sorry I never came home. For every lesson I failed to teach here, these words. Shave in one direction with strong, deliberate strokes to avoid irritation. Dribble the page with the brilliance of your ballpoint pen. Walk like a god, and your goddess will come to you. No longer will I be there to knock on your doors. You must learn to knock for yourself. Knock, knock down doors of racism and poverty that I could not. Knock, knock on doors of opportunity for the lost brilliance of the black men who crowd these cells. Knock, knock with diligence for the sake of your children. Knock, knock for me, for as long as you are free, these prison gates cannot contain my spirit. The best of me still lives in you. Knock, knock with the knowledge that you are my son, but you are not my choices. Yes, we are our father's sons and daughters, but we are not their choices. For despite their absences, we are still here, still alive, still breathing, with the power to change this world, one little boy and girl at a time. Knock, knock. Who's there? We are. This is Daniel Beatty, your host for Unscripted. And that was Knock Knock from my play Emergency. Knock Knock is a part of my own story and my own journey with my father, who has been in and out of prison 60 times over the course of my life because of his battle with heroin addiction and also selling heroin. Emergency, Knock Knock, and my journey as an artist to transform my pain to power through words, through performance, has been a beautiful gift to me and something that I'm excited to also explore with my guest today. Our journeys to use our art to transform the moments that are difficult or the issues that we find are challenging into something more powerful, more hopeful, and more possible. Now for our guest.
Hi, everybody. This is Susie Orman, and soon we'll be launching my new podcast, Women in Money. Don't you miss it. On the show, besides having a lot of fun, we're going to answer financial questions from listeners, and maybe, just maybe, we'll even put you on so we can have a chat. Wouldn't you just love to talk to me? So be sure to check out Women and Money on Apple Podcasts, podcastone.com, and the new Podcast One app.
She's a combination of undeniable humor, clarity, intelligence, and strength. You know her best for her roles in Vice Principals,
Kevin probably saves the world, Better Call Saul, Two and a Half Men, and Brooklyn Nine-Nine. She starred in two shows at the Geffen, including last season's Barbecue and By the Way, Meet Vera Stark, earning a Drama Desk and a Lucille Lortel nomination. Oh yes, she slays the stage and screen, but she's also degreed with a BA in psychology from Mount Holyoke College and a master's degree in social work from the University of Chicago, and that's the school where the brainiacs go. She's an advocate for families and special needs children, a voice for mental health services in underserved communities, an actor, a thinker, an advocate, a friend. Please welcome to Unscripted, Kimberly Hubert Gregory.
I'm floored by that introduction, like near tears. Thank you for that. That is a most illustrious description of a very humble and, in my consideration, a very pedestrian life. So thank you very much. I'm moved by that.
Well, it's all true. And thank you for taking the time to come and be one of my first guests here on Unscripted.
Absolutely. Without question. And thank you for the invitation.
Yeah. How are you doing?
I'm actually doing really well. Yeah. You know, taking the moment, I don't know how philosophical one will get.
Yeah, definitely.
At this moment, but I'm really taking in the time to post-work, you mm-hmm. know, because we've wrapped a very long season.
How many episodes did you do on Kevin Probably Saves the World?
We did 16 episodes.
Wow.
On Kevin in Atlanta, which was interesting and lovely, but also different because you are away from home.
Yeah.
And so I am readjusting. It's like a re-entry.
Yes.
into real life, right? So I've really been trying to take the time to remind myself that this is, like, life is the thing that I do. And not fall into what's the next thing.
Sure,
you know what I mean?
Sure.
What's happening next? Is there a second season?
Right. Well,
agents, call me, send me. And I was just like, you know what, Hubert, just take your time and know that life is the thing that you do and should be doing best. So
yeah, that's
I'm
beautiful.
Really having a moment.
Well, that's great. And I think that's a perfect place to start.
Okay.
Because in my experience of characters of yours that I've seen and love, you know, regardless of if they're comedic or if they're more serious, there is an assuredness and that I find that you bring to your work. And I know for me personally that my own journey to become and my own journey to know myself and to figure out who I am impacts the characters I portray. So how does your journey to become and to know yourself impact what you do?
You know, it's so... I can remember when I was a young theater actor, and I just knew that I knew that I knew that I knew that I knew, you know,
yeah.
Like there was just something in me that was like, I know, and grateful for all of the training. You know, I went to a performing arts high school in Houston. Mm-hmm. I studied in London in undergrad, and I just, you know, knew that I knew that I knew that I knew that I knew, but I had no real life understanding. And I had no, now that I'm realizing, I really had no real understanding of self. Like it was, I was still working through those roles and those categories of self of, you know, educated, you know, respectability politics, you know what I'm saying? So all of those things. And now that I'm older and I see life as the most important kind of training for character building for me.
You got some seasoning on it.
Been around a teacup long enough to get to the handle is
okay.
What my mother would say.
Right.
That's how my mother would describe it. I have seen that handle several times over now.
Yeah.
And I feel like what life has offered me in struggle, in joy, in parenting, in a person who was at one time married in a committed relationship, and having those things kind of kind of open up in a way that I, as a young Kimberly, would not have imagined.
Right.
Really broke me open in a way that now allows, and I'm hoping is allowing me to approach life and characters with a lot more empathy, compassion, nuance. You know, and I even think, like, in anger, there are so many levels to the why of the angry outburst, you know? And so I do think life has provided me that kind of insight and the journey. And, you know, I will not say in any way, shape, or form that I have my stuff together or that I'm there.
We're all constantly evolving.
I mean, if we're not, we're... You know, the other alternative in my mind is either, excuse me, a literal death or that horrible figurative death that I think, and metaphorical death that I think many of us, and I see people walking in it.
Sleeping while awake,
sleeping,
I call it.
Yes. Yeah. I call that, I call it soul murder. You watch people who have just
given up,
given their souls away. So, I mean, it's a journey and it's... It's exciting and it's scary because it takes courage.
Absolutely. Courage is a big word.
Yep.
You know, let's talk a little bit about Kevin Probably Saves the World, because even the title alone in your character, Yvette, who's leading, you know, messenger leading him on this journey, like, we're living in a time where there is a lot of sleeping while awake and a lot of people feeling hopeless and like the world is in this crazy place. How do you feel a show like this speaks to the moment?
You know, I think what I love about Kevin Probably Saves the World and its intent and potential for the world, at least for our country at this moment, is that it allows for that lovely kind of imagining of positive possibility. And I love a good apocalyptic television show. like I go in for that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I think when we are actually faced in the day-to-day with something that has felt so very dark, whether you're on the winning or the, you know, the metaphor.
It costs something.
It cost us all something, and it is costing us something currently.
Yeah.
So there is, I think that Kevin allows, it reminds us, because I truly believe that the human spirit, that spirit in human, is always looking for good and always wants to move us forward. So I think Kevin has that intention and that possibility in viewing to remind us all that, yes, that administration or this world might look a certain way, but it is populated by individuals who have the fortitude, should they find it, to make different choices and to change.
Absolutely.
Change self, change world, you know.
Absolutely. That's absolutely. That's one of the things that I've been saying lately is that aspiration creates relatedness.
Aspiration creates relatedness.
Yeah.
Tell me more about that, because I want to be on that. That's my new ministry. I want to go to that church.
Well, to me, that's what you just said, right?
Yeah.
It's that that window of possibility in the darkness, that looking for hope in the midst of seeming hopelessness. You know, it's just that little window of it that shows us that we're connected to and related to one another. And that's really, I think, what the artist's call is, right? So we start with what our character's objective, what's our character aspiring towards. And as we pursue that, then we create characters that people can relate to.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I love this. I love that.
Yeah.
That window.
Yeah.
Talking about that window brings me to this notion that there are many windows, and I think it's interesting that artistically, globally, sometimes we are only looking at one very narrow window.
Right. Right.
One very narrow window, and that we're all trying to go through that window as
yeah.
opposed to, like, you guys don't see this, but we're in this lovely, you'll get, maybe they'll put a video up of it, but we're in this lovely podcast
yeah.
one where there are drapes mm-hmm. over some of the windows.
Right. Yeah.
And we have gotten away from pulling back drapes.
Absolutely.
Like ripping stuff down.
Yeah.
And I think the artist, I think artists, and I don't even want to qualify because in my mind I was like, well, good artists.
Go on, qualify. Go ahead.
I think I was having this conversation with a fellow artist. We were walking yesterday, and that kind of pulling back of the drape takes a kind of fearlessness. Mm. It takes a kind of particularly transitioning from theater to on camera.
Yeah.
You know, they are like, get in your box.
Yeah.
You know, stay, look.
Yeah.
That box is going to work for you, so stay there. That's your working box.
Right. And no artist is really a box at all.
Oh,
we're actually the complete opposite of
it's
it.
The, and I was like, because what we're all the artists, we're trying to accomplish and recreate is when we, that freedom that we felt when we were kids, when you jumped off the bed with the, you know, the cape on, or you sang with the brush, you know what I mean?
Right.
What you created in your imagination was so freeing. And one friend was saying, I remember being on stage and going, oh, I hope somebody forgets their lines, because then I'm going to have to get, we're going to be able to get
it's
in.
Get real.
Yeah, it's going to get real. We're going to make some stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and now it's so, if I'm working on something and I can't remember a word in a line, I'm like, oh, God, I can't believe I can't.
Yeah.
When we were really about moving the drape. And if the drape fell by accident, we were like, hallelujah, look at the light. Let's go. You know
right,
what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'm really, really pushing myself, particularly with the blessings of the on-camera things that I've have had the opportunities to do, and how wonderfully aligned I feel they are.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remind myself. That's why I'm taking this moment to be like, Kimberly.
Yeah, yeah.
Pull some drapes down. You know,
Pull
some drapes down. Look through other windows, and I'm really excited about that.
No, I really love that too. And it's interesting how even doing what you're doing, you've been pulling down drapes and pulling back drapes.
Okay.
And so I read something you were saying about not even thinking about TV and film initially because of not seeing people who looked like you or reflected your experience. And so you are carving a space, and I think that's very interesting. And that leads me to another of your characters and shows that really did pull back the drapes, I would say, as well, which is Vice Principals and Dr. Belinda Brown.
Come on, Belinda.
Now, when I first watched this show, and I'm just keeping it real for everybody listening, I was like, no, these white men are not coming after her like that. And I was like, HBO, what are y'all doing?
What y'all saying?
Yeah, so for those who may not know, Dr. Belinda Brown is this degreed black woman who takes over as a high school principal in South Carolina, where there are these two white men who are trying to essentially destroy her in order to have that position.
Uh-huh.
And it's controversial and it's real.
It's controversial. It's real. It's absurd in its approach to it. And when I, it's so, listen, Daniel, you know me.
Yeah.
Will doesn't. Will is the,
Will
is producing and engineering us today. But I am one who has consistently and categorically looked for representation.
Right.
Like, if I'm looking at a show, I'm looking for me.
Yeah.
I'm looking for my father, my son.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm looking for my brother, my aunt. I'm looking for us.
Yeah.
I'm looking for a reimagining of all of those people that of the people who are important to me, of the village that I represent.
Yeah.
And this is the and I say that because this is what I found odd. When I read the scripts, I knew it was me on the page that when it said Belinda and the lines, I knew it was me. And I did not understand the impact of a black female body in that space with two white men trying to take her down. I mean, like, and I...
Right.
I didn't.
Right.
Like, I didn't see, it didn't, like, the optics weren't there. I'm reading words on a page.
Right,
you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I was reading the words on the page and understanding, like, nope, we're not going to say that word. And, you know,
right.
I mean, I said a lot of words, but there were certain things that I was like, we're not going to write that in my mouth. Okay, we can take that out.
Yeah.
You know, or, oh, okay, that's, have a conversation about that little moment. Okay. And what I, once we started, like, once I saw some of the dailies, I was like, ugh. I understand. Like,
right.
They did burn her house down.
They did burn
and,
the house down, yeah.
But this is the thing that I find interesting, and this is why I'm excited for Get Out.
Yeah.
I'm excited for Black Panther.
Yes.
I'm excited for these, the optics.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that's what we have not really dealt with. And so in curating a Belinda Brown, once I realized the optics, and I'm still fascinated at the fact that, like, Kimberly, you of all people, like, race person you consider yourself, didn't see it coming.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad it came, though.
Yeah.
You know, because here's the thing.
Yeah.
Because if we don't insert racialized, gendered bodies to disrupt the notion of complete and utter, oh my gosh, am I going to say white patriarchy? White patriarchy.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
White patriarchy.
We're seeing it in our government. We can name it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
White patriarchy. If we don't disrupt it, insert ourselves, then we are complicit in the ongoing mythological narrative of its power. Like, this is all ex post facto, right?
Right.
And I didn't know this was happening while I was doing it, but Belinda was a powerful disruption to white patriarchal comedy on television.
Yes, absolutely.
And I also think it said to many that a black person, a black woman, can stand in that space, take up that space, excel
in
that space, and you have to, you can no longer dismiss that.
See, I'm so with it, and I'm so with this moment, which leads me to my next question that I want to
ask.
I am, like, I'm radicalized to the point that I am a very fierce advocate of female leadership. You know, I think that patriarchy, white male patriarchy, but just in general, has done a lot of damage to our country. And I was raised by a dynamic woman, dynamic black woman, but I believe women have, you know, tremendous intelligence, but also an emotional intelligence that a lot of men, you know, fight to embrace and understand. And that's not, of course, across the board, but
I think
it's largely true. And we're in this moment of, you know, time's up and Me Too, and where there is a reckoning and there is a pendulum swing and there is a boldness in saying we will not be silenced. So as someone who plays characters that represent that, someone who is that in my experience of you as a human being, how do you feel about this moment?
I am encouraged by the moment. mm-hmm. and cautioned mm-hmm. by the moment. And I say that because I went to Mount Holyoke, which was all women's mm-hmm. college, which is still, thank goodness, an all women's college. Mm-hmm. And I'm feeling very bell hooks.
Mm.
About the moment, y'all.
Break it down for people who might not
understand. Okay, bell hooks is a fantastic black feminist theorist. And here is what I need for us to know in a movement. I need to make sure that we are not replicating what our original feminist movement, which was primarily led by white middle-class women. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why Time's Up mm-hmm. is very, very interesting.
Yeah.
Because they are giving a counter-narrative and a counterpoint to white privileged, a white female privileged perspective mm-hmm. of feminism.
Right.
So when I say bell hooks, I'm saying yes, and I don't want it to sound exclusive. Mm-hmm. I'm saying yes, and but we have to make sure that what we are, when we say Me Too and Time's Up, that we're not saying we want to replicate in female body, mm-hmm. male patriarchy.
Oh yeah, oof, that's profound. Yeah, absolutely.
You see, I want a radical toppling of patriarchy.
Right.
That's what the feminist movement is for me. Mm-hmm. Is that we have to reimagine as women. So, for example,
and I just want to just interject too, because I know exactly what you mean, mm-hmm. a radical toppling of patriarchy, but that doesn't mean all of a sudden men are without opportunities or, don't have any, right, that too, but like, are not going to have any voice. It's actually the same way that when we build for the margins and we create space for the
yes.
least of us, that we all are better, it actually creates a better society for
exactly.
everyone.
Exactly. It's yeah. that conversation that people were having after Charlottesville.
Mm-hmm.
It's like when people say, I want a piece of the pie,
yeah.
someone is saying, you're taking some of the pie from
right.
me.
Right.
That's not what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting that there is enough pie
yeah.
for all of us.
Right.
And I don't want this movement of feminism, which mm-hmm. is which is why I think Frances McDormand's mic drop.
Yeah, she's incredible. Yeah. she's incredible.
Because that yeah. said to me,
mm-hmm.
on one level, there's been access to that power if you spoke to it.
Right. Speak truth to power.
If you spoke to it, if you said, yeah. okay, yeah. if it was important.
Yeah, exactly.
You see?
Yeah.
You know, and I understand people don't share that information because you don't want to share that
and
information.
And we're talking about the inclusion
writer.
Yeah.
Thank you.
On a film, your production, you can request that, I think it's up to 50% of your
yes.
crew and cast mm-hmm. be diverse. And, mm-hmm. You know, lead actors of influence can request
actors
this, demand it.
Demand it.
Yeah.
And so with that, and that's why I say a toppling, because we can't have these notions that, well, you know, I'm a lead and I want to maintain my position of power.
Right.
So we that's what I mean by
yeah.
a real bell hooks kind of feminist theory, where
yeah.
we are not trying to replicate patriarchy. We are demanding full equality, full recognition of humanity, full recognition of dignity, and full recognition of my talent.
Yes.
Because see, here is the caveat that's happening, and I've heard so many of my white sisters
mm-hmm.
in the industry saying, cop this. My agent told me I didn't get that job because they went for color. They went for diversity. Mm. And I said, danger, Will Rogers.
Yeah.
That's dangerous because we cannot build, we can't build a feminist movement with an industry or with subversive acts like that, saying that your rightful place was taken from you because they wanted to do they wanted to be inclusive. And this is when I tell my white sisters, y'all gonna have to stand up with us on this. You're gonna have to stand up and say, I don't have a right to any character. The characters are open. Like I don't have the right to always be the ingenue lead or the strong police. I don't have a right to that. And push back when your agent says that to you.
Wow.
And call it what it is.
So, wow, you are going so deep.
No.
I've been going deep, and this is what this is about. Okay. Because one of the things, too, is like they used to say to Paul Robeson and the great artist activist, shut up and sing, right? Mm. But what they don't realize is that, you know, artists are deeply intellectual. And what it takes to inhabit a character, to make a character, requires perceiving the world with such clear eyes, you know, in order, in order to have voice and to make a statement. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I believe is that artists have a core role to play in social justice movements.
Absolutely.
And it's part of the conversation we're having now. Mm-hmm. And I want to stay where we are, but shift a little bit because what you're speaking to is a legacy of systematic oppression and disenfranchisement that creates certain social norms that people buy into as absolute truths.
Mm-hmm.
And the disruption of a moment like this when we're like, actually, that's not an absolute truth.
Exactly.
You know, and there is a, I would say, mental illness that is pervasive in our country.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the deepest root of that is this illusion that we're separate from each other and that we're not responsible for each other. I think that's the deepest mental illness. Mm. And then that manifests in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I know from you studying, you know, psychology and then getting a master's in social work is your understanding and your care about these issues, and it's actually a priority issue for me, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I read in an interview of yours that you were saying that, you know, before acting, you know, became such a clear passion for you, this vision of, you know, bringing mental health services to underrepresented communities and under, you know, and Jay-Z recently said something similar, and I have a nonprofit, I Dream, that lives at the intersection of arts and mental health. And I call it, and I want to talk with you about it, because this is the kind of root conversation. I call it leaf versus root conversations. So our leaf conversations are, let's get, you know, kids out of gangs. Let's get teenage pregnancy rates down. Let's get more people going to college. The root conversation is, how do I see myself? Do I think my life has value? How do I see my community? You know what I mean? You know, and so talk to me about your passion for that and your understanding of the need for that.
Oh, Daniel. I mean, I need the couch. Because this is the thing that, like, identity shapes us. And how we have developed our identities, particularly, how we have developed our identities is so connected with what other people tell us we are, how other people interact with us, and how we then, from those interactions, go out and either agree or disagree with that. And this root versus leaf is so profoundly, it is, you know, no pun intended with root, but it is deep.
Yeah.
It is deep-seated, and it is it's a buy-in mm-hmm. to be a part of mm-hmm. a greater community. And so
ooh, that's powerful.
It's,
yeah,
it's a buy-in. Mm-hmm. It's a rough buy-in. Mm-hmm. And I think from my perspective, when I graduated from college, I had no intentions. I'd done it in high school. I did it in London. I was like, oh, that's good. I'm gonna go, because I was feeling like the root of problems for Black people, and that's my area of entrance, interest.
Yeah.
Because when you see trauma close to you, when you see how is it that my sister and I, we go off to college and my cousin doesn't make it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
I do.
It gets swept up mm-hmm. into agreeing with what?
The lie.
The lie. And then saying, then having a community living in a lie of
that
its...
That affirms that.
That affirms that lie. So I began to really kind of question, okay, how? Why? And if I did it, everybody on one level can do it, even in your own space, in your own. I'm not saying you leave, you move. So I became really deeply interested in racial identity development, which I think being in this country and being a person of African descent is it's paramount to understand the racial construct and how you then feed yourself and keep yourself whole racially as a human in a country that's going to continue to feed you something that is really not who you are as a human being. So, the work that I wanted to do when I was graduating was to go back home, places when I lived in Chicago, which I did. I went to the projects. Yeah. I went into those homes and the system around it is challenging, but if you can break through and have a conversation with the human being, because the human being is also caught up in the system and in its own narrative. So that to me is so important. It's so vital. It's so needed. That root, the leaf stuff we can do.
Right, right.
And we have been doing.
The leaf
stuff is really easy because it's not challenging the tacit agreement.
Right.
Made by everybody.
Right, right.
You know, and when you start to dig up that root, you're asking different questions.
Right.
Well, listen to this guy. His name is Drew G.I. Hart. He's a PhD. He's a theologian. Mm-hmm. And he writes about racism and how can churches kind of have conversations about racism. And he says it's interesting because in all of those years of enslavement, Black people were getting it right. Like this, hey, y'all, this is wrong.
Right.
That's not right. This way of doing it, Frederick Douglass, all of those abolitionists were saying, that's not okay. It's wrong.
Yeah.
And then at a moment, somehow, you know, white folks go, yep, you're right. Civil rights. Black, that's wrong.
Women's rights.
LGBTQIA. At some moment, we are going to, there, and we're in this moment again where you will have to look back at what we're saying, what all of these communities are saying, and go, they were right, because history shows that.
So let me link this back to the phenomenal artist that you are. And it, for me, these connections are very powerful, right? What you just described is vision, right? Mm. So there's a story at the heart of everything.
Mm.
And in any movement, there are people who have a vision of a story different than the one that is the collective agreement at that time.
Mm-hmm.
The story of slavery is that Black people are less valuable, that our bodies are for sale. The new vision is that we are full human beings and we have equal possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Story of women's rights, somehow women are less valuable.
Yes.
You know, than that story and those liberators. And then we enroll other people in the vision.
Yes.
For me, this is why artists are so important in general. But so important in this time because we live in the realm of vision and imagination. It's our craft, it's our skill, it's our call to see what's not there. You know, and so to me, that's what you're speaking to.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that's the call. And you're doing that, and you've been doing that.
Thank you.
You are in your career, and that's all we can do. And so I just want you to be encouraged.
Yes.
You know.
I am.
Yeah, I can tell
am.
You are.
I really
yeah.
am. I'm excited. And yeah. I'm coming up with some ways in which to keep myself connected to that creative thing, which is something that I'm developing as a theater collective.
Oh, wonderful.
Bea Richards Theater Collective.
Oh, my gosh. She was so... Bea Richards, if you all do not know, bless yourself. Look her up.
I mean, bless yourself.
Oh, my God.
And it's really a gymnasium.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I were in New York, so you know what the Lark and New Drama is where you come in. And because I feel like in this town, artists are buying into a story of book.
Yeah.
If you're not booking, you're not doing it. If
right.
you're not booking, you're not valuable.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're not getting the end, you're not an artist.
Yeah.
And so I remember being in New York, and if I went to a reading, if I just went to New Dramatists and read a script, you know, the space is there. So I'm working now to create a space for artists to stay in touch with what we're really about, which is freedom.
Freedom.
And I'm really optimistic that this collective will take off and
Absolutely.
Take wings. And we welcome you and your amazing vision and artistry.
So thank you. I appreciate that. And I will definitely show up. I want to ask you one last question sort of as we wrap up. You being blessed to call you a friend and to know some aspects of your life. You're a mom.
Mm-hmm.
You're a thinker. You're an artist.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you fill your tank back up? How do you take care of yourself?
I have come to a place where now I know when my tank is empty.
Right.
You know, because there was that moment, I think, for many of us that we feel like the running, the rushing, the trying to get it all together is really exciting and makes you feel like you're alive. And the quiet is the thing now that really grounds me. I'm blessed because I have a notion of almost like a nuclear family. Like I have a son to whom I go. And
he's so special.
Oh, he's
I've been so blessed to spend time with him.
He is the most, he is the creation, the artistry outside of me that I am most proud of. The thing that I did with the help of his father, yes. And he's a wonderful man, too.
Yes,
just
absolutely.
A wonderful human being. But to have that, to be able to see that outside of myself, to see that there is something much more important, much more interesting than I.
Mm.
He's much more interesting than I am. That is the thing that I pour out and somehow he pours in. You know, it's if I guess you know, if there are three of those, you can't see this, those cups that go around and I, you know, it's it's him. Yeah, it's a flow. It's a beautiful flow. So if I stay in that flow with what is real, that's why I said I'm really taking advantage of being in life. Life is the thing that really fills me back up. I'm a deeply spiritual person. So always working on my non-dualistic thinking and trying to embrace creation as something that was divinely is a divine offering, and that's something I can't take for granted and shouldn't take for granted. Mm-hmm. And that creation is not just the trees and the hiking, but it's you.
Mm-hmm.
It's Will, it's me.
Yeah.
And also that me part of that creation has also become very important, like how I have to nourish this me thing for me to even have something to pour out.
Yes,
I mean, you know
absolutely.
What I mean? So I'm
absolutely.
I'm really grateful for I'm grateful for trials. I mean, this Franciscan priest named Richard Rohr, he says he prays for one humiliation a day. I'm not there. But but there is right. something about acknowledging the beauty and the suffering, the paradox of how beautiful it all is, but then having the ability to see that it could be better. I
Absolutely.
Think that's where I am, and I'm
so
happy.
I love that, and I think that's so beautiful. My version of that, understanding of that, is this idea that we're all wounded healers.
Oh, love it.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, a lot of times there's something in our capitalistic society that makes us think very individual and about our needs being met, the gift of parenthood, the gift of love.
Yes.
The gift of being an artist is the desire to take those wounds, to take whatever we have and to try to give it externally. And
heal the village.
Heal the village. And then when we're about healing the village, then our stuff gets taken care of.
Absolutely, all the time.
Yeah. So thank you for
lovely, unexpected. Didn't know we were going in there, but happy we went. Thank you so much for this. This was lovely.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for your intelligence and your strength.
Oh.
Thank you for your realness. You are real. And you are intelligent and strong.
Thank you. I'll take it.
You know?
I'll take it.
And, you know, I see you. I recognize you.
Mm.
And I'm aware of the space that you're carving. And I'm grateful for that.
Thank you. And thank you to the Geffen. They've been great supporters of... they've seen me.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
And I want to say I see you, too. Uh-huh. And I thank you for... how you reflect back in such a intimate way. There's something very intimate about the way you can take the broad strokes of what someone is saying and give it back in such a personal and intimate way. That's a true shaman. That's a true healer. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful that you gave back to me those things. I'm going to walk with them. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. And with that, this is your new host of Unscripted, Daniel Beatty. Until next week, take care of yourselves and remember, we're here for each other. It's not always the big actions that change the world. It's how we show up for each other day by day. Our lives are unscripted, ever evolving creativity. And moment by moment, we get to choose the role we play.
Thanks for listening to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Be sure to download new episodes every Wednesday on the Podcast One app, at podcastone.com, or on Apple Podcasts. And don't forget to rate, review, and share the show on Apple Podcasts.